Thanks for listening to Other People's Flowers. If you'd like to have your work featured in the program, please send it to editor@otherpeoplesflowers.com. We hope you enjoyed this episode.
All this week's stories are by Sheila Mannion. Sheila is an Irish writer living in New Zealand. When she can write, she writes. When she can't, she reads. And on occasion, she plays the ukulele. Sorry for your trouble. I'm right at the end of the front pew, after Joe, the youngest. I should be beside Neil, the eldest, next to my mother. I should be in between him and Sinead, my younger sister, but I'm late, and I missed my place. So I slot myself in. There is a lot of snuffling, cold rather than grief. I steal a look at my sister. She is wearing a darkly patterned, floaty thing, hanging on her like pondweed, all hunched up inside herself, her face tight and pinched, the muscles in her jaw clenched. She is close to tears. She was always a crier, and I love to comfort her, hurting her just so I could. Words far better than sticks or stones. Go away, I don't love you anymore. Or worse, nobody does. I would walk away, count to 10, turn and hold out my arms. She would run to me then, and wrap herself around me, damply sniffing and softly solid. A small warm ball of a girl, clinging to me, holding me up. It felt good, we were close then. Now she's all angles and corners, sharp and brittle. She's older and easier to break. Now I generally keep my distance. I try to catch my mother's eye, but I can't quite see her. Just her shoes, the usual black leatherette. I hate the greasy sound of that word. Cheap and shiny as licorice. I think about how, when she's gone, I'll take those all-sort shoes and have them stuffed and mounted. Or I'll imprint her feet on one of those ceramic blocks meant for pretty baby feet. Meant for display. Perhaps in the toilet. Where we put trophies and such like. Where we put things we pretend not to care too much about. My sister can keep the ashes. I watch her shoes shuffle on the cold stone floor of the church. I can see the shape of her feet staining through, and I remember rubbing them. I often would, though they repulsed me even then. I was very young, and still eager to please. I remember her big toes, how they slanted and listed cruelly inwards. I would pull them straight, gently but firmly, until the bones cracked, smooth oil over toenails thick as scabs. Even rub her bunions, like lollipop heads, under the shiny, taut skin. She loved that, the care and attention, and I love being the one, feeling sure of her favour. Both of my brothers are in suits. Joe has the cheap one. He hides in it. He is never quite in charge of his clothes. They either hang off him or look as though they are the only thing holding him up. He should eat more and smoke less. Neil has the expensive one. He is encased in sleek grey pinstripe. He looks prosperous and overfed. His colour is high, his hair thinning. The word gouty comes to mind. He should smoke more and eat less. The church is freezing. The stained glass windows people rave about look gaudy and harsh to me. Light shines through them, splashing a wasteful spill of colour on the floor. The priest rattles on. He didn't know him. He would have less to say if he had. My stomach rumbles loudly. No breakfast. I can see Sinead squirm at the noise. I wasn't deliberately late, but she won't believe that. She will think it a gesture of defiance. I am tired and sad, though it is not his death that saddens me, but his life, and now the death of any hope of change. There is silence. The priest has finished and it's time for the viewing of the body. We stay where we are. We have already seen it. One by one we went. He looked like a ventriloquist dummy, diminished and emaciated. His body lacked substance, and his head was a pointed, mean and vicious-looking thing. Recently shaved, the skin was scraped and sore, and the lips were dry and tight, and not quite pulled over his ruined teeth. In life, he had been almost dapper. In death, his features frozen and his mouth still, he looked closer to who he was. There is a line of people now, walking slowly up to see him, in his faux silk lined box. The coffin was the cheapest we could get. There are a miserable few bouquets around it. Sinead must have bought them. She shouldn't have bothered. They look worse than none. Inside, he is wearing a charity shop suit and a ridiculous pair of runners. My mother's touch. She is already joking about them. out of Sinead's earshot. I anticipate the scene in the pub later. There will be humour and then hilarity, black as his suit. Her cursed consolation and her revenge. If you can't laugh, she says. Yes, it helped her endure. What she'd have done better escaping. What we all would. We sit and watch them file up there slowly. They will come to shake hands afterwards. I sent Joe steel himself, then feel him stiffen. I am afraid to touch him or make eye contact. We do not react well to sympathy, or worse, kindness. The tension ripples down the line of us. This is the part I have truly dreaded. The first one is here now. She is a friend of my mother's. They are all friends of hers, or ours. At the end, there is no one for him. We are here for ourselves and for each other. She takes my mother's hand in hers, saying, sorry for your trouble, and she is patting and pressing and looking as she says it. And she does this all the way down the line to me. And one by one, we bow our heads and my hand is in her hand. And I hear those words that I have despised and feared for their simplicity and power. And they are echoing down the line, for there are many saying the same words now. And there is something, something almost sacred. And there is a great solace in this touching and saying and such beauty in the sincerity of the words. And one by one, we are undone.
Hindsight. It is only now that I'm married and have had children that I realized that I did not actually want to get married or have children. I merely did not want to not get married and not have children, which is quite a different thing. I was ticking things off the list, which I love to do, and now, though granted, I have one less thing to be done. I'm sorry I did not know myself better, and in particular, I did not know how much washing was involved. Waited. My mother told me the story, cautionary I think, about a small girl sound asleep on a bed. They were having a party. Someone threw a coat over her. Then someone else. Then another, and another, and another. Making a coffin of cloth, weighted and airless. At first her mother couldn't find her, the image fixed in my mind. I see her encased in cloth, the sorrow of it heavy, thrown over me like one of those coats.
Van Gogh via Bacon. Once I saw a yellow bucket, sunflower yellow and full of red, fleshy, fierce red, fish-like but not a fish. I saw a head, something fished out through, spooled and slippery shiny, veined and coiled as a pair of eels or some other briny creature, something grown in the deep dark, then expelled, pushed into the world. Too early, never spoken of, but remembered, that vivid picture, that untouchable little sister thing. Advice. On my wedding day, as I dressed my hair, my hands shook, and my mother said with a crooked mouth, "You'll be all right, just keep your legs open and your mouth shut." She laughed as I winced and went on to flounce down the aisle, despising her bitterness, her bile. But 5 years later, and three kids on, my husband left and gone, I think on her black words and know them for some sour kind of wisdom.
Postpartum. I am stripped of a skin stretched too thin. A freight train of pain imploded me, starburst-like. I am stripped of a skin stretched too thin. Now everything hurts more. I am huge inside and too easily moved. Behold the sun, all or more than I ever wanted or wished of this earth. I curled myself around him and compassed. Match breath of breath. Sleep only when he sleeps. Both more and less now us. I'm stripped of the skin, stretched too thin.
Everything that matters has already happened. I spoke to my sister today, at length, for the first time in years. This is not to say that I have not seen her in this time. We see each other frequently. But today we were alone. It was not planned and there was nowhere to hide. We spoke of things that mattered. We said what could be said. We were kinder than we are usually able to be. I am not sure why. My mother was not there. This may have helped. Of course, there is also the leaving. As I am to absent myself, we can put our weapons down. We came a little apart that day, and in the doing came together. During this ceasefire, as we talked as we had not before, she recalled things, things I have spent my life forgetting, fill her mind still. They are prodigal and poisonous. I was freshly pained and angered. We cried and then we laughed and smoked and drank more coffee, and were comforted by this fragile solidarity. Smoking always one of the few things we do well together. And what of tears when we have cried so many? Though I do not imagine we cried for the same reasons. It was good to shed those tears. It was good to laugh. It was good to be together. I came away feeling lighter. I understood that. As she looks back, I look forward, and I understood the need for this. I understood that for us the present is nothing, the past everything, and the future always just before us, there, in between the trees.
Confession. I told my mother a true thing. For maximum impact, I said I sold myself. She dragged on her fag, blinked, and said, "For money?" "What else?" I said. "How much did you get?" she said, exhaling. "Too much and then not enough," I said, waiting. "Sure, why wouldn't you?" she said. "Might as well get something for it." "I didn't do it for long," I said. "Just the 3 times. "I see," she said. "So what were they like? Good, bad, and indifferent?" I said. "I've fucked worse for free." "We all have," she said. "Not all," I said, looking at her directly now. She looked away, crammed the butt in the ashtray. I kept looking. After a while, she said, "What did you need the money for?" "Need it," I said. "I just wanted it. I wanted not to be the way I am." She sighed and said again, "I see." "And then what did you spend it on?" "I spunked it up the wall," I said. We both laughed at that.
Stigmata. There are parts of her body, soft, secretive, mostly hidden, hers the more so. She cuts them. She showed me her inner thigh, inside arm, lower belly, just above the pubic bone. "I used a scalpel," she says. "A fine blade, a beautiful and useful letting. The pain succurs, scars witness, blood evidences. I'm done with crying," she says. "Me, I don't cut. There or anywhere, my memory a finer blade bar none yet honed. When I remind myself of who I am, of why, I let it pierce me, my mind, my body. The sweat and tremble of it, the shear, the sear, the slice, the shame of it. Get down on your knees, on your fucking knees. Say sorry. Beg me. I will stop." And she did, but he did not.
Island woman. It must have been cold when she went into the water. It was May, always a fickle and changeable month, and that year had been particularly sharp. We found her boots on the beach, placed neatly side by side, along with a silver hip flask of whiskey. Never her drink, but it's a romantic spirit, and she always did have a sense of occasion, a sense of what was most fitting. What she left looked styled, a little tableau, something that might win a photography competition. It almost made me smile. Back at the house, everybody crowded into her kitchen. Nobody took their shoes off. There was a lot of talking and sighing and crying and smoking. There was a hushed, crushed excitement in the air, and it was loud with people being busy. They were questioning, discussing, and of course arranging. There was tea and whiskey and cake. Somebody looking in the window might have thought it was a party. I wondered if the whiskey had been bought by her on purpose. There was no note, but I knew. She was gone. I knew why she'd gone, and now I knew how. When they found her body 3 weeks later, she'd travelled a long way from the coast of this island. The currents carried her, as she knew they would, far away. She was identified by her much regretted implants and her much lamented teeth. She would have hated that. It almost made me cry. So it is over for her now, but not for her children and not for me. They are bewildered and bereft. They are almost always angry now, except for the beloved one, the last one, her Opus. She is cushioned by her father's devotion and perhaps the knowledge that she had the best of her. She can let her go. The other two shared another father, weak and mostly absent. They shared a less enlightened version of her. They cannot let her go. She would have known that too, and drowned with it. It's been 9 years. Only now do we begin to speak of her when we are together. This is not often, though. We take care to track one another's footsteps from a distance. Me, I feel unentitled to the measure of my grief and also afraid to express it. I was a cuckoo in that nest, you see. It was freely given, but still, I took a piece of her from them, and I fear they feel this too. She loved me so well, and she loved me easily, as my own mother could not, and as she too could not love her own. I do not mean she did not love them. She loved them very much, perhaps too much, if such a thing is possible. But she believed she did not love them well, at least not when it mattered most, when they were young and as yet unformed. And when she too was young, too young. So she did not love them easily, and this weighed on her. I spent that last weekend with her, 3 days before she went, and we talked of these things and more. We talked of how hard it is to love well, of how hard it is to live well. She said that to live is to love, and that to love is to live, and we spoke of the joy and despair of this. Feeling sad then, and a little overwhelmed, we listened to Joni Mitchell's Blue. And we both knew the words, so we sang them out loud and strong. We were a little drunk by then, but it felt good. We talked also of our mutual love of water and of our island nature, how we love to be visibly surrounded by water and of the peace this brought us. We spoke of the width and depth of the oceans and seas and of the never-ending possibilities of them. So much money spent on space, we said, and so little on water. We laughed at this, and merry now and always comfortable in each other's company, we went on to talk of the luxurious embrace of warm water, the voluptuously supportive silkiness of it, and then to finish the delight and shock of cold water. That reviving plunge which made you feel as though you had managed to reverse the aging process, albeit momentarily. Then laughing again, but also wistful now, we spoke of the slight sense of renewal, of rebirth when coming out of the water, and then leading on from this, but contrary to it, of the improbability of change. She told me then of her most recent disappointments, and of her exhaustion at the prospect of more, at the inevitability of more. She said she felt she had done what she could, that she was tired and that she had no desire to begin again, to start it all over again. She said that she had begun to think on absence, on how it could be more powerful and more beneficial than presence. And I could only agree with her. It is a truth I have lived myself. In retrospect, I wish I had argued this point, though I do not truly believe it would have made a difference. And also, again, in retrospect, I think that somewhere then I knew. I knew that she was saying goodbye to me, as she was when she cooked for me that night, and as she was when she waved me off the next morning. And I am glad, in some way, that she felt she still could. I still see her so clearly, I always will, freeze-framed in the doorway, smiling at me. I saw love in her eyes, and I saw sadness, and I saw intent. Still I let her go, I waved, what else could I do? And now, though I wish she were still in the world, that she had stayed, and though I am forever lonelier without her, I am comforted by the knowledge that she sought and found the support of water, that she chose her death as she could not choose her life. I believe it to be a bleak kind of victory for her, and I believe she had the right to choose it. It eases me to think of her in the arms of the ocean, cradled in the deep, though it must have been cold when she went into the water.
Other People's Flowers was produced by Hugo Gibson, Chris Kamonvutitam, and Hamish Adam Cairns. If you'd like to have your work featured on the show, please send it to editor@otherpeoplesflowers.com. Thank you for listening.